Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Hang on, because I'm going to, hang on, let me open
okay,
my drink.
Okay, let's get going.
It's time.
Yeah.
Everyone quiet.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone quiet.
Shh. Oh. Yeah.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast. It's our happy hour edition. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Lewis, my tongue is already tingling.
Okay, good. We are on our way. The happy hour has started. Coming up on this special episode, we've got drinks and we have stories. We're joined this week by two special guests. That's Alon Stevens. He's a reporter from The Trace. And Greg Moran, he's an investigative journalist formerly with the Union Tribune. Each of us, and that means every one of us here, will share a story we think you should know about or some kind of history that people will benefit from. This is new for us. We could go big, we may go small, we may go weird or nerdy, but no matter what, we'll learn something new. In this episode, you'll hear about a secret history between the government and the gun industry. A collision of worlds as Andrea's love for the show Selling Sunset meets the reality of tenants' rights. The incredible story of Fat Leonard. And I've got a little water history for you. It's going to be a good show. Grab your favorite drink and stay with us. All right, we're going to start with Lopez. What are you drinking?
What's your drink of choice? I'm terrible at accents. I'm drinking a gin martini. All right. You know, I'm feeling good.
I haven't had a drink in quite some time. A little sip would probably have a big effect. All right. So what do you got for us?
Okay. So I think you might have shared this on our Slack channel. It was like an example of, I don't remember what you were saying. It was one of your many lessons.
It must have been really important. Yeah.
He shared the link and he was like, this is an example of something, blah, blah, blah. But all I saw was Selling Sunset. So I clicked. And if you're not familiar with Selling Sunset, it's this like trash TV show on Netflix. It's basically about like these really like gorgeous over the top women who sell real estate in Hollywood. And so they like, the whole show is like you get to sort of see these beautiful mansions, which is mostly why I watched it, because I wanted to see these gorgeous homes. And so they tour, you know, they're like, oh, this is a $5.3 million home, blah, blah, blah. And they walk you through it. But obviously the drama and the chisme is like what draws you in, right? Mm-hmm. These girls are fighting about being the top real estate agent, and there's like a new girl. And
is it like, do they cut away and like the
away to like the one-on-one interviews? Yeah. So it's a lot of cattiness, like the new girl's kind of trying to figure out the dynamics of the Oppenheimer real estate group, and she's asking questions, and then her questions get telephoned to the other person, and she's like, oh, you were talking crap about my friend. And no, I wasn't. And like half of, like, well, actually more than half of the show is just these like women fighting about things mm-hmm. they said or saying they didn't say.
So like baseball.
No.
That's all baseball's become is all these like hurt feelings and side comments.
Oh,
sorry,
sure. Okay. I thought you were talking about, you know, the actual game and stuff.
Nobody follows the game.
Okay. Yeah. So it's just the drama and it's really good. It's really terrible. It's like in its sixth season now. So like I'm not the only one who's, you know, absorbing this, but it's become quite the thing. I think like on Instagram, people like TikTokers have actually looked into these women and, you know, do they even have a real estate license? Like, are these people real? And they do. And there's a post, actually, I don't remember what website it is, but basically they created a post from a TikTok video of someone looking into like how many of them actually had real estate licenses, how many had them like real listings and MLS. And so there's all these terms, you know, like escrow and, oh, I'm an escrow and all these things. It's just really crazy. But people on social media really are consuming the show and like figuring out how much the girls make, because during the show, they'll say like $5 million mansion, blah, blah, blah. And then they explain the commission. And so, you know, these women are making like a lot of money. So anyways, this is like a world that's, you know, I've been consumed by for a little while now. Okay. And when you shared that story, it felt like two of my worlds were coming together, like journalism, this really terrible show that I can't stop watching. And just like this overall question of, you know, how expensive it is to live anywhere. And yeah, I think it was just a fascinating story. So the story is from the LA Times. And the headline is called Selling Sunset Star, Evicting Rent Control Tenants Whose Landlords Set Fire to Their Homes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this was Liam Dillon's story this mm-hmm. weekend.
Story.
It was a great story.
Great yeah. story.
Yeah.
This is craziness to be
crazy.
Honest.
Crazy. There's so much craziness in that headline yeah. that you're just like, what? You know, like I got drawn in by the Selling Sunset, but then
okay,
I was
so
like,
whoa. I'm glad that you did that because I had no idea about Selling Sunset. So now it adds even yeah. more flavor.
But it's
to
not
that
even
story.
Part of the story. Right. Like Heather, so Heather is one of the characters in Selling Sunset. Uh-huh. And you kind of follow her through her love life because she's like a single gal and whatever. And then she meets Tariq, who is now her husband, and mm-hmm. he's the one who really, I think, like it's his sale or his flip. Yeah. He has a flip show. Or,
okay.
Right? Is that what you call them? Like yeah. when you flip homes? see, but like he's exactly the main character, but like she's not, but they use the Selling Sunset to draw people in because I would argue she's probably a bigger
yeah.
deal, or that show's a bigger deal than
Flip or Flop.
Is it?
Yeah.
Flip or Flop?
Yeah. See? Yeah. Okay, so explain that story now.
So Tariq, who's Heather's husband, he yeah. has this flip show. He's on Instagram and they're both very like, they're very big personalities on social media. Like she got pregnant. She shares all of that. She's like the stepmother to his children. She shares all of that. So you know way too much information about these people.
Or apparently just enough to be
to rope you in.
Yeah.
He goes on Instagram and he posts a video of himself and he's talking about you know, big plans he has for this property. He's gonna flip. It's like the greatest flip of his life, and he's so excited. And you know, that's kind of how the story starts. But then it drops when it says like the one thing he doesn't explain and he leaves out of that video is like how this lot was even available. So it's kind of an ongoing message in Selling Sunset, and I think a lot of these shows that focus on like Hollywood real estate, how unaccessible it is, or how lucky you are if you find a piece of real estate that you can build on or flip, obviously. So that was his point. And basically, this property is available because the current property owner will set the building on fire trying to kick out the tenants that lived there. And a lot of them did leave, but I think some of them stayed. There's like four or five of them that stayed, five tenants that stayed. And so now they're being evicted, and it's like a collision of worlds, right? So the tenants by law are supposed to get money to move out of this place. But they think like they should get more money because of how much money the flip is going to make the property worth.
Also because the guy tried to burn them down.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this guy trying to like
something.
Burn them out.
Arson coming. What's the arson?
And they're living there.
It's got to be worth something.
They're living there. Like there's five tenants and they, I mean,
the
one
place
of,
has been burned.
place has been burned.
Plant tenants there.
Terrible conditions.
And this guy's like, hey, I got this great flip.
And it's going to be on TV. Like, pay us out. Pay
and
us
you're
going to
watch
out,
the okay? flip. And he has this YouTube video where he's like, this is the greatest flip of my life. And look at this property. And we just bought it. And it's like this terrible looking place.
Where is it again?
In North Hollywood.
Okay, yeah.
And he's like, look, like there's nowhere else you can develop. And yeah, around him, there's like newer apartment buildings. And he's like, if you're an investor, like this is your chance to really get something started. And it's just insane. But I think it speaks to, you know, the cost of living. Like these five individuals who are staying there, I think one of them is 77 and she pays $824 a month to live there in this like building that's like half, you know. Mm-hmm.
And it's rent controlled, right?
Yeah, it's rent controlled. And so, you know, a lot of the tenants are kind of like, where are we going to go from here? And it's a really dark story. I think it's a really sad story.
And then after the story came out, like Liam was tweeting about how this guy was like kind of tweeting through it, right? Like he was trying to like handle everybody's concerns. Like, well, I'm going to build a lot of places here. It's going to help the housing affordability or something, right?
Like, yeah. But then he gets into his story like, even throughout all of this, so there's an Instagram post, and I honestly didn't go back to find it. I'm sure it's been deleted already. But so Tarek posted about it, and he was posting about this development, and he put a fire emoji. A fire emoji.
I'm sorry to laugh at that.
Yeah, I kind of saw some of that post-game, and in addition to trying to tweet through it, he was just completely – people were then coming after him and saying, yeah, what are you doing? And he was completely oblivious to their concerns, saying like, well, what time do you get up in the morning? How frequently do you work out? What's your diet? Yeah. And it's like, dude,
No, no, he was trying to say like you can make it in this country. Yeah. Don't feel bad for those people. They basically have made their choice to be that way. You can choose, like I chose to be rich instead.
Right. Yeah. I chose to have an apartment
go for that
by the landlord.
I started with zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. It was kind of like one of these huge, you just see the gap, not just between owners and renters and, you know, TV stars and civilians, but just the two different worlds of the inequality in America. I mean, if you have money, if you don't have money. And the disturbing thing is just how tone deaf he was to the concerns of these people. I mean, it's one thing to have a lot of money and things like that, but Warren Buffett's got a lot of money and he still seems to kind of understand that not everybody does.
Yeah.
The sort of new breed of people are like, what's your problem?
But you know, this is the weird intersection. First of all, I got to make an aside. Like, we got to pay these actors and script writers to just, like, for real. Like, we can't, like, you see what reality TV is doing. They're like, we can't write it. We'll just do it. Like, no, stop. Like, just go back to. But, like, no, it's this weird thing because, you know, we as journalists, right, like we're in a way we're almost competing with them because people look at this as this reality TV to them is a documentation of the world. Totally. Right. And so it's setting up these like really false expectations. I mean, I know tons of people that are like, I can do this. They make it look so easy. Go out here and just grab and hustle and stuff like that. And
it's like a prosperity gospel.
It's like a prosperity gospel. Right. And so that's why you see that kind of mentality in Twitter and that like celebrity that comes out in social media because they have to keep that act up because they're selling the reality part of the TV. And like, of course, like we see the behind the scenes and like, all this is shiesty. It's all dirty and it always has been, right? I think we like known that, but yeah, it's that prosperity gospel, right? Like I think that's the scariest part.
Those expectations, like as my kids watch those shows and they think, oh, look, you just like his flip or flop show. Yeah. You know, in 22 minutes, he takes a dump and then he sells it for like, you know, more than he.
You just stumbled upon this property. Your wife is fine. Your life is tight. I'm making all this money and I'm on TV. What are you doing?
And they do all these things. And they go in there, oh, we'll just take down this wall and we'll run a thing. You know, and it's like, you have any idea how complicated this is? You know, and I would tell my kids, you know, you've seen me try to change a light bulb. You know, I mean, imagine moving walls. This is not something you do in 22 minutes. You know?
To your point, though, like I've been describing this a lot. Like, I think our attention spans are like a balloon. Like, they will, like, some gas will fill them up. And it's like, we have, as local news journalists or as journalists, we have earned a little bit of that space. But the moment you disappear, even if you don't publish for a while, like you said, like stay in the game, even if you're gone for a little bit, that gas will fill up with something else quick. Mm-hmm. And they won't even know they're missing anything. So like we worry about these newspapers, about all kinds of journalism jobs and stuff like that. Like that, there is so much willing to fill people's balloons and they won't have an idea that they're not getting the best possible version of reality they can. Right. And they love that version, that there is a chance to get your foot into an investment. Mm-hmm. Also, let's point this out, like the journalist, Liam, what a great idea. I don't know if he got a tip or you know how he got that, but like he saw that it was worth digging into.
Yeah.
I mean, this quote is really, I think it like speaks to what we were talking about, but this is from one of the tenants. And so, like I said, they're very public people, like they're everywhere. There's this trend actually that I've kind of thought about doing for us in our TikToks, but it's like a trend. So all the real estate agents dress like incredibly crazy and they're mm-hmm. going to show like they look like they're going to some opening of, I don't know, like the red carpet, right? Yeah. But they're just going to show this client a house. Yeah. Or they're doing the staging for the house, but they're like in like 6-inch heels, makeup and hair. So people have done this thing like showing up to your office as like selling sunset. And so people are dressed like super over the top for like a staff meeting, you know? But like that like luxury life, I think. So this quote is from one of the tenants and she said, "It's an insult when I know he's spending his summers in the Hamptons and in Cabo, and he can't make time for tenants whose displacement is enabling the biggest flip of his life."
Well, that was a great start to the happy hour story time. I think I didn't know quite how you were going to connect it like as well as you did, but that was
Thanks.
Great.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm talented.
Yes. Alon, you've been a guest before. Thanks for coming again. Thanksgiving episode, bunch of others. We appreciate it. We knew you'd have a gem. You're a reporter at The Trace. Tell us what The Trace covers.
Gun violence in America. So, you know, that niche, small topic.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. We cover what I like to call, you know, the heavy metal beat, right? So it's all things gun. So that's from the lobbying, the industry. Right now we have some international stuff going on. It's police shootings, militia movements, extremists. Yeah. All of it's kind of connected.
Alon, so what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Shiner Bock.
That's right, a good sized one. Yeah.
Yeah, tall boy from where I'm from, which is Texas. And it's the perfect beer to talk about guns.
Uh-huh. So. Beer, right. Texas, guns.
Yeah, big beer, big guns. Here we go.
Let's go. So you have a story about that secret history of firearms and the U.S. government. So tell us about it.
It's a podcast. It's a series.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been working on this, you know, since the beginning of the year. I've been covering gun violence now for a long time now, for like 7-8 years now. And so, you know, when we look at the nation and kind of the national conversation going on around gun violence, we're essentially having it in the dark. Right. If it seems cyclical, it's because it is. For the most part, we only talk about it when it's a mass shooting. We usually only talk about it in the context of a mass shooting. And the sad part about it is that is only a small sliver. That's only about 2% of all gun violence victims. Right. So we're having these very expensive, very politicized debates over things like an AR-15 ban that, you know, I'm going to be frank, if it were to go into effect right now, America wouldn't feel much safer than it is, you know, currently where it is at right now. And so part of that is we wanted to make a podcast that really dissected a couple of things. First of all, where did all this come from? One of the things is that it's very hard. You know, I kind of describe this. It's like, you know, when we look at America and the gun industry and our history around this, it's like, it's hard for America and American people to understand because we're trying to describe a car, but we've been born and raised inside of it. Mm-hmm. And so you almost got to step outside and be like, well, where does this come from? And you find a couple of things. Historically, right, it's woven into what makes America, America, right? From the very ground up, all the way from George Washington. The second thing is that the Second Amendment and a lot of the rise of these early gun companies were risen on the backs of white hegemony, white control. And that was done at the support of the government. And all of these things still track to causes and effects to this day. And so it's not just a podcast where we kind of go into the history and talk to researchers, but we talk to like current gang members and like what types of guns they're carrying around now. We talk to Black people trying to enter into a gun industry that is very racist. And we go back and say, well, why is this industry very racist? And what is it about this culture that still ties to that? And there's research that says, listen, right? It's no mistake that the parts of the country that have the most gun holders today were the same people that had the most slaves in the antebellum South right before Reconstruction. And that has been researched. And so we're going to get into like all of that. And then on top of that, just how we as taxpayers right now have our fingers kind of in gun companies because we have a lot of support for this because it is an American industry that we export. And so we don't realize that, you know, whether you vote for this or not, your tax dollars are going to gun companies through Department of Defense, through research and development grants, through police spending. And all of those are linchpins of support, right, that go into gun companies that go back and use that to send it to the NRA and fight for their own types of industrial absolution and political
things like
forces.
They're protected from suits of people who are victims of violence.
Yeah, it's absolutely kind of it's an industry because it is so powerful and woven into our identity that it is held and treated almost like any, you know, like it's in it, like I said, a category of its own. So like I said, they're absolved from most lawsuits. You want to talk about defund the police. Right now, you know, the NRA lobbied very hard for the Tiahrt Amendment, which says if the ATF releases trace information, right, information that can tell Americans about the origins of crime guns, where they come from, right, that could show us where bad gun dealers are and, you know, bad gun sellers are. If the ATF releases that, they go under. That was written into law. They lose all their funding. And so it's like, you know.
Just to be clear, that if the trace data that is collected and literally traced by the government.
Yeah.
That if the government released that to the public, which the public ostensibly owns, we deal with public records all the time. It's not itself part of what we would normally think as accepted exceptions to those kinds of rules. That if they release that, that it would automatically trigger the defunding of the ATF?
Of the lead federal agency responsible for regulation of firearms industry and federal gun crime.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I mean, and so, yeah, it's just like that. And in fact, it was public. Let me tell you a story. Up until 2003, it was public and reporters like us and cities would go out and say, hey, look at this. Like this gun store, Joe's Gun Store, it's not anyone else's. Joe's Gun Store, we found out, has a disproportionate amount of guns ending up in crimes. And they would use that to sue, right, those gun dealers, those gun makers. The NRA said, we cannot have this happen. So they lobbied through a guy named Todd Tiahrt, a congressman in Kansas. And they got the Tiahrt Amendment passed, which said, yo, two things. If the ATF were to ever release this into the public again, it used to be just a $25 CD-ROM. But if they're like, if they ever release this to the public again, it would trigger defunding of the ATF. And then the second thing is, if you were to get it anyway, you cannot use it for a lawsuit. And so this is like the world that like we operate in. And so I'm going to keep it real. Like over at The Trace, we're trying to figure out ways many times around that. And so we try to build our own trace databases. We look for leaks, we find them, but it's a very important bit of information. We know that because that's what they went for, to cut that information flow off.
How much of that kind of origin story you're talking about, how much of that, like this is embedded clearly in the DNA of the country. How much of that, if you know, was kind of the product of sort of an industrial policy, which is like, hey, gun manufacturing in the 18th century, 19th century were making a lot of product, employing a lot of people. And how much of it is kind of woven into the sort of the cultural makeup of the American?
I love this question because this is right like in the crux of the podcast, which is so the first time that America really, I think, dealt with firearms in the way that we kind of think about them closely more to today was probably about the early 20th century, where a couple of things happened. The firearms technology advanced very, very rapidly. So among the 1900s, we get some pretty crazy technology that pops off. Suddenly you have suppressors, automatic weapons become man portable. We have sawed-off shotguns, right? Sawed-off rifles, no rules, no regulations. And then on top of that, industrialization makes things like revolvers and small handguns faster and cheaper to produce. So we have two things, high-end types of weapons, and then we have these really, really cheap weapons. So this is the 1910s, 20s, 30s, Prohibition goes in. We have all of this violent crime, right? And so this is the first time where the federal government, we don't think about the federal government in the terms of what we think about the federal government. Most people rely on the state government. But at this time, because of the Great Depression, because of failing banks, because of modern day crime that is being executed with vehicles and automatic firearms, things that we've never seen before, serial bank robbers, hostage negotiations, these types of weird kind of high level things that have bring out the FBI, right? New federal agencies. People start looking at the federal government for answers. Right. And they're kind of like, listen, our conditions right now are apocalyptic. The unemployment's crazy. What are we going to do? And it's so violent. Actually, someone takes a shot, tries to assassinate incoming and elect FDR, President Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And so they're like, we've got to do something about this. And so they come up with the National Firearms Act, right? The first bit of federal gun control. And so they're like, and this is why we don't see machine guns and stuff like that, like Tommy guns out on the street to this day, because this is the regulation that comes in that says, listen, sawed-off shotguns, rifles, machine guns, these types of things are going to be regulated to get these off the street. But at the same time, during this time, they're having some very interesting conversations about regulating pistols, right? Regulating this. And I'm just today, I was going through the NFA testimony and the vice president of Colt.
What's the NFA? In.
Oh, the National Firearms Act. So this is the bill that they're talking about. This is a federal thing. It's the first time there's any sort of federal conversation about any sort of gun control.
This is in the 30s.
Yes, in 1934. And so what happens is the vice president, and I think this is kind of chilling, of Colt leans in and says, if you regulate firearms, right, we cannot ensure that the gun companies will survive to exist to supply you with the weapons for the next war. And they did this in 1934. What's going on in 1934?
Rise of Hitler, yeah.
Right. And so they're kind of like, okay. And so this is how you see, right, them say, all right, we're going to allow pistols. We're going to allow all this other stuff.
Almost like violent crime is like a test innovation lab for war fighting. Isn't that what they're kind of saying? Like, we need this.
In many ways, it's the opposite. They say in kind of ways that America's domestic violence problem is an acceptable bleed off to a much needed military industrial complex that adds us to be stakeholders and influence makers globally. We have nothing to say or do across continents until after
it's
World War
collateral I. damage of this massive war fighting machine we're creating.
Right. I mean, listen, the thing that makes America us, that we all benefit from, whether we like it or not, is that we are the global influencers through our military policy. And we do that through very, very expensive Department of Defense spending. Now, I'm going to say something that all my San Diegan Marines and everyone else here are going to cheer for, but we also know that wars are still fought at the end of the day with dudes, right, with guns. And for some reason, because of our American mythology, we have like tried to divorce that, but that is still cold. That is the same people that made the revolver that, quote unquote, won the West and essentially colonized indigenous people out of here. These are the same gun companies that, like, I've just put this all in a context. You know, Colt was the same person that would sell to the antebellum South and say these were the guns that was used to take down Nat Turner, and then go up to the North and then sell it to abolitionists saying this is the same gun that John Brown was using, right? And this was the same Colt that would go and talk to, you know, the NFA, and it's the same Colt that would also be the first private industry battle rifle maker with the M16AR, which is what we're debating right now. And they are still there. And this is like a multi, you know, century company. And so that's so what the podcast sense, is about. Let me drink some beer.
Your question being like industry versus culture, the industry creates the culture.
It does in some ways, although that bleed off argument kind of fails when you look at some of the great arms merchants of the world, Israel, Great Britain,
have very strict gun civilian gun control laws.
And so I love that you say that. I love that you say it because, see, other nations, and that's why I came back to that mythology. It says part of that mythology, because other nations, they have Germany, right? They have some really great small arms, but what they do is they firewall it.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's a firewall, right? It's there. It's implicit, right? That, you know, what is for the military is for the military. What is for them is for them. These types of industry and civilian ownership are two different things, right? But because of that mythology, which is more so built a little bit closer to, partly due to the fact that, you know, when this country was created, we had some internal security threats, mostly with the face of indigenous people and slaves, right? And so one of the early reasons why Americans really kind of got married to the Second Amendment, right, was the fact that all throughout the American South, people needed to be close to arms to put down slave rebellions at any given time. There's nearly 300 of them, right? And internationally, Haiti was a major part of concern. And so if you, like, this whole idea that the militia was this awesome fighting force that fought off the Brits is, like, not true. Like, George Washington and all of them hated it. The militia were not this irregular fighting force with, like, Mel Gibson running around making his crack shots. The problem was, it's true. You look back at it and a militia is like what you'd expect, dude. Like, sometimes they'd show up, they wouldn't show up sometimes. They leave when they want to. They were irregularly trained, blah, 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 blah. But here's the thing. When we were like writing, right, the Constitution, and we were like coming to terms with like what we wanted to, you know, create this country like, the people of the South had gone all in on the economy of slavery. And they were like, listen, we are scared of a federal standing army. And to this day, you can actually see that, right? When the next part, right, like the next amendment's like, oh, we're afraid of like quartering. There's a reason, because the British government was super brutal to them with the standing military. And to this day, we still have all these like United States standing military things about deploying militaries here. And they were aware of that. So they knew that it'd be a slow, laborious process. But they're like, what do we do if we have a slave revolt? And they're like, we need a bunch of people with guns. Because militias, albeit not particularly great at war fighting, are particularly great at quashing, right, unarmed slave, right, rebellions, right, where they have every advantage pretty much in their face. And so this is a lot of the reasons why we can't kind of divorce that. We kind of get that early mentality of carrying around guns. As we go into Reconstruction, that maintains, right? Black people get political power. And so they, more white people kind of marry to carrying around firearms anyway. The crime, again, goes up. And then this kind of conflicts with our military industrial complex, right? So it's like these same people have these very intimate notions of firearms are also faced with the fact that we have a country that's really good at making a lot of firearms. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of that, the legal protections for them kind of grew up after the industrial policy to kind of preserve those things. I mean, journalists are real fond of saying, oh, it's the only business that's constitutionally protected. And I always thought, no, go one amendment down.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty good constitutional protection there that's much more closely honored than the First Amendment.
Yes. And so, much more lucrative.
More lucrative. And and a lot of that kind of legal superstructure that protects the gun industry and kind of emboldens, you know, more and more manufacture is really a product of, you know, it being so heavily embedded in the culture.
So your podcast is like, just here's how it is.
Like, yeah, that's a lot, man. It is a lot, but I go through it through history, and then, you know, but I also try to bring it to the now, just like, how does this affect us now? And so I bring up some clever cases of just like what's going on now that people just don't, you know, think about gun companies who kind of outwardly are like, we hate the government, we're independent of them, right? You know, the government, whatever, Molin, Lave, come and take it, blah, 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 blah. But their whole, you know, their whole success and rise to fame is like DOD contracts and stuff like that. And, you know, and simultaneously, a lot of their products are like super famous among mass shooters, like super famous, like there's patterns that, you know, you could pull out. And so it's just a weird thing that like people don't, you know, kind of like pull these types of things together, I guess, to me.
So I'm seeing a lot of stories right now about fentanyl, right? So fentanyl is an incredibly dangerous and lethal drug. It's incredibly addictive, and it's now very cheap and accessible. And so it's causing a lot of problems. And a lot of the prosecutorial effort behind the effort to, you know, put them in jail or otherwise quash them, which we've had a great success with the war on drugs for so many years. But a lot of it is actually taking the step further of going after the providers and accusing them of literal murder, right? Or of, you know, some degrees below that. And so they, I find it really interesting because I always, when the gun stories come up, I always pretend like put fentanyl in the headline or fentanyl in the thing, and it would be a completely different discussion.
You're super smart for doing that.
Yeah, you would go through this whole process of like, well, the actual provider of the weapon is a problem that we need to go
after. So I lecture and I use this, and this is what I use because you can actually see it. Yeah. I could put it to you in real time, right? When we look at the prosecutorial appetite, right, for, yeah, things like drugs, okay? We have started moving away from the end user and we go towards the dealer because we have determined that they are the net kind of harm
the user
giver of
the
community,
the victim,
right? And so, sometimes. But when it comes to trigger pullers, right, like guns, you know, we put all the prosecutorial efforts on them. But when it comes to the dealers, right, there is hardly anything. And I mean, like, I have this where I know for a fact that there are certain prosecutors out here who will not work with the ATF, who are like, I'm not even going to bring a case out here on some of this stuff. But the craziest case of this is there was no arms trafficking. There's no federal arms trafficking law on the books until last year. So there's nothing to actually do. Like, you know how there's like drug trafficking laws and they're doing this since whatever? Like literally, I would talk to federal agents, right? And they would move, you know, they would see people move weapons, right, across the border to Mexico. And I would watch these cases, right? That's like what I do. I'm hanging out in Pacer looking at federal cases. And if you move a weapon, right, across to Mexico, they have to get you with some like super weak law. Right? That would be like unlicensed seller and stuff like that. So the cost, right, these people get paid, you're not getting a trunk full of money. You're getting like $100 for a gun. And the reason why is because if you get pinched, you're walking. I'm watching people moving machine guns, right? They're getting 18 months. Okay. And so I'm talking to federal agents and they're like, yo, we have nothing to get them on. And because it's so controversial, right, no one wants to put up that law. In fact, the arms trafficking law got buried. Right. So no one even knows about it.
There's no international arms trafficking. Because, I mean, if you go to Arizona and bring a weapon across to California, that's a federal offense.
No,
it's not.
That's a state. You violate. So check this out. I'm going to start telling secrets, man. So, for instance, California Department of Justice, right? What they would do is years ago, they would run a secret operation where they'd have their DOJ agents go over to Nevada. Follow people who go to gun stores, right? Get guns that you can't have in California. And they would wait until they cross state lines and bust them over here when they got back in jurisdiction. But when it came to the ATF, right? If you moved weapons, right, from anywhere, it would be like, oh, unlicensed transfer until just recently.
Yeah. And so then use the parallel of drugs, and it's it's just completely different. And yet, and they say, well, that's drugs. There's a value to firearms. They serve all these purposes. Well, the same thing with opium, right? There's an extreme value in medical settings for fentanyl even, and for all these medical uses. So it's like, it's very interesting.
Well, one's a killer. One's kind of like a death is a potential hazard. The other one, death is explicit.
Death is the goal.
Right? Yeah. And so it's just, but again, like we in America, and I'm not really blaming anyone. I mean, we benefit from it. I think that's the crux of the podcast. We benefit from it in a variety of ways. I think it helps us sleep at night, right? Like, I think, you know, I'm not a solutions guy. I've actually never really done a story where I'm like, do this, gun control that. And that's not me. But guns are symbols, right? That's why people fight over them. You know, we're most of the guns in America are sitting under a bed, like collecting dust, right? But the reason people are fighting over them so viciously is because they mean something, right? Perhaps it's a political statement or, you know, an opinion about how you have distrust of the government or you believe in might makes right, or you're just a little bit paranoid about safety and you're going to take it into your own hands. The thing that I'm here as a reporter, and it's always been my goal, is just to remind people that that's great. Gun can be that for all those symbols, but it can also and is also for some people a tool of the trade. And that trade is to do some messed up stuff with it, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to accept that cost. You want that weapon. You want to have that freedom. That's cool, right? But you just got to know that cost. And that bubble, people don't like that busted. They don't like that burst. Mm-hmm. It's like, listen, it's like, yo, you want to have a car? Cars are fast. They're cool. I love my Mustang, but it runs off of puppies, right?
Oh, and it's just God, like, people are like, never.
I don't know. I don't know about it. And yeah, you may not know about it. And so it's just like that. That's cool. And I'm a gun owner, but I just, you know, I look at my gun a little bit different.
Well, Lon delivered too. That was good. Thank you, sir.
Wow. If cars ran off of puppies, people would be walking away.
We have a lot more bike lanes.
Yeah.
All right, Lon, you've got people interested, I think. Where would they continue this story?
So the podcast is called The Gun Machine, How America Was Forged by the Gun Industry. It's being made by WBUR Boston and The Trace, so you'll catch it on both of our websites, but wherever you get your podcast.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzan, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
All right. I didn't know what to bring to this, so I went to my my heart, which is public policy.
What? Not baseball or softball?
No. I started as a reporter here in 2003. 20 years now. My first beats were real estate and water, or housing and water. And I remember being really sad about that because I thought those were terrible beats. But it turned out that real estate in 2003 in San Diego was a really interesting topic and was, you know, going through at that point just a massive bubble. And then water, 20 years ago this month, there's a massive historic deal that was signed between all of the Southern California water agencies about sharing water. And it was a historic moment. So 20 years has now passed. So we should be looking back at that. But one of the big things that was starting at that point was desalination. So desalination obviously was a very expensive process across the world, but you know, had never really been introduced in this country. And there was a company, Poseidon, that was promoting it hard. And their concept was that they were going to build a desalination plant in Carlsbad, where there was an old power plant. Because power plants and desalination plants share something in common. They bring water in from the ocean, in the power plant's case, to cool the generators. And in the desal case, of course, to turn the water into potable water. So when I started at the Transcript, they used to have this thing where we had to profile or do a short profile about somebody in the community, some in the business community. And so I got assigned the guy who was running this project. And so I went to meet with him, and I was a brand new reporter in San Diego, knew nothing. I've, you know, never touched the ocean. I'm a surfer now, but you know, I was just new to San Diego, and
what
I go,
is this water thing?
Yeah, and I
go,
I can't
imagine a Scott that doesn't know anything.
I know, right? So I was just like, I act like the know-it-all. But yeah, so it was a very interesting experience to go to the waterfront, to go to this old power plant that they wanted to convert, that they had already leased and already ready to make this big bet. So this company was making this gigantic bet that they would be able to sell the government, San Diego, on purchasing water from the ocean. It was like a classic American, like, government private property combination, the capitalist sort of private partnership. And so I was like really interested in the science. My wife is in the Navy, and she had talked to me about reverse osmosis and how the water can be transferred from the ocean to, that's how all the Navy ships operate, is they use reverse osmosis to turn that water into something that people can drink. And so I was learning about this. Carlsbad in North County has a ton of these businesses that produce this reverse osmosis technology. And so I found it really interesting. But on the other hand, it became very clear that this was just extremely expensive, that they were asking the San Diego ratepayers, water ratepayers, to make a massive investment, like a really, really expensive investment in this company. And this company had all kinds of troubles from their past. And so I realized like, oh my gosh, I have this like big assignment to understand this like thing. And of course I didn't do a good job of it, but I picked up a little bit along the way. And I remember following it very closely since then. Like, and they would get really sensitive. There was a guy, Scott Maloney. He was, do you remember him?
Oh, yeah.
PR guy. He worked for Jerry Sanders, the former mayor. He was like a bulldog. Like, if you did a desalination story and you had anything that he thought was like a little too like off or critical or something, he was a bulldog. Like, he would come and he worked really hard to be in your ear. Like, you would think about him when you're writing. That's what the best like PR guys like that do, is they get in your brain. And so they were serious. Like, they would, like, you would look into like their past or something like that, and they would be all over it. But they were ready. Like, if you think about what they were trying to do, they're trying to make a deal with the local, they were trying to introduce a concept and make a deal with the local government at like a massive scale. And so it went on and on and on. And the County Water Authority was really distrustful of it for a long time. And they were really hostile to it. And so a lot of these stories were these back and forths between the nerds at the Water Authority and these capitalists trying to sell this community on this concept. And so they would sponsor all of the taxpayers' events and these different, you know, civic things. It was a really interesting thing that was being laid out. And so finally, around 2012, it starts to become, or it didn't start, it had evolved to where it was getting to final approval. At some point there, I don't remember exactly the dynamics, but the Water Authority's politics shifted so much that they're willing to make the investment. And I think it was more just like a really long, drawn out negotiation. The Water Authority had made it clear decades, or I guess at that point, about 10 years before, that they wanted to diversify their sources of water so much that they were willing to take some big risks and spend some big money. And so so it seems like it was just a long drawn out negotiation. And they finally get to 2012, and Bob Filner had just been elected mayor. You know, this was like a really interesting time in local politics. Doug Manchester had taken over the Union Tribune, so there was a lot of emphasis on like big business, big stuff, and stadiums and all this thing. And so they're ready to make this deal, and the Water Authority is going to agree to buy water, 50 million gallons of water a day from this entity, and at a price that was outrageous, like super high. And their entire pitch to the public and to reporters like me, and I wrote about Rye Rivard, picked up on it a little later, Rob Davis, a lot of people at our place followed this story. And so this was like a really high price to pay for the water, and they would justify it. They said, look, importing water is really expensive too, and the Colorado River is drying out, and this Metropolitan Water District has us. Like, they own us. They control us.
It is a hostage. They're a monopoly. Situation.
They're a monopoly, basically, on our water.
It makes me
and
thirsty.
They're going to drive up the cost of that water relentlessly over time. So if we produce 50 million gallons a day of our own water, like we're going to be in a position in the not too distant future, and they showed the graphs, where we're paying less for this extremely expensive water than they would be charging us. And the biggest part of the cost is the energy it takes to force water through these filters. So they get and they present these projections as very clear that the water is going to cross the threshold where it's just cheaper to buy this desalinated water and we'll be better with the apocalypse coming and everything, right? Mm-hmm. So fast forward to now, and there's these water agencies leaving because they feel like we pay too high of rates. And they have avocados, like Fallbrook has avocados. And avocados take a lot of water, so much water. And so if you're paying these really high sums, so they ended up creating so much water capacity in San Diego that we actually had to like dump it. This extremely expensive water we were getting from desal was just being like, we couldn't make use of it based on all the other stuff we were bringing in too. So they had to dump it into reservoirs to be recirculated through the system. And it was just like a really interesting development how much we were spending on this. And our rates became the highest, if not like close to the highest in all of the country for water because we were paying for this diversification. So these water agencies are leaving and the water authorities really upset about it. And so I check back and it occurs to me like, oh yeah, I should ask them like if it ever got to the point where the imported water was more expensive than the desal. And it became very clear like, oh no, not even close. Like it's like not even on the same like path now. Like the trajectory of the cost of desalinated water has like accelerated and the cost is of the metropolitan water, yeah, it's gone up. But it's nowhere close. It's like $400 per acre foot cheaper. An acre foot is a foot of water over an acre. That's how they measure it. And so they, I found that really interesting. And I called the water authority because I felt like I needed to talk to them before I talked to the public about this, you know, history. And they're like, and the new guy, there's a new general manager, Dan Denham. And he gets on the phone with me and I'm going on vacation that day. So I'm doing the interview like before we're driving. And he says, what about these projections? They never crossed. Like they're like 10 years or 11 years ago, you know, you guys said that it was going to be not too long before desalination was cheaper than this imported water. And he said, yeah, we were wrong. And I was just like, what? This, the water authority had never been like this to me. They'd never been like very open about like vulnerability, right? And so he's like, yeah, that was wrong. And we got to be really a lot better about making projections like that. Like, yeah. and acknowledging it when we're wrong. And I was like,
yo, that's what?
I was like floored. I was like,
what's this dude's name?
Yeah, Dan Denham. And so he's the acting manager of this.
All right.
Of
he's
this
never going to be permanent.
No, actually, they just extended it.
Oh, God.
Or they just agreed to negotiate a permanent contract with him. What
was driving that? I mean, was it just the increased cost in the desalination? Was the Metropolitan Water District kind of holding down the price? I mean, was there more supply coming in? I mean, to diverge that much,
what was the driver?
Thanks for asking. So there's a few.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, there's a few things that went on. One was the cost of desalination has soared because the cost of power has soared. Oh. Just like we're all paying the highest cost of water, we're also paying the highest cost of electricity. And that SDG&E will have 1,000 reasons why that is. And one is that we've invested so much money into these large solar projects at a high cost before they got cheaper. And we're locked into contracts similar to the desal contract, right? They agreed to desalinate the water in exchange for us buying it for 20 years or whatever. Same thing happened in power. We'll agree to produce all this power if you agree to buy it for 20 years. And so they bought it at really high rates. And then they also like bought, all the infrastructure, the power lines. And they're also a for-profit entity. So they pull some of that around based on the infrastructure that they build. And then the general cost of like all types of power and fuel and everything. And then the Water Authority also made all these deals with these farmers in Imperial Valley. We agreed to pay farmers in Imperial Valley to stop farming and to let the water go. The All-American Canal, if you ever drive along the 8, you'll cross the All-American Canal. I stare at canals. I would just stare at them because they're such a fascinating thing. They're bringing water in from hundreds of miles away.
That's what you're doing out there.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. the canal used to be dirt, and it would leak all the water out of it into Mexico. And in fact, there was a burgeoning farming industry in Mexico based on the groundwater that they were able to get from that. And when they decided in this deal with the water authority made with the Imperial County farmers, it agreed to line the canal with concrete so that that leakage stopped and the savings of the water would go to San Diego. But in Mexico, that became like a diplomatic crisis because all these farmers were suddenly going to lose access to this water. So there was provisions put in for that as well. And so that all of these deals that we made, the new reservoirs, the desalination, the cost of energy, it all just soared while importing water was kind of the same process that it had been. Still went up, but nothing like that. That's a little bit
the
of why
that was. Desalter machine's too expensive to plug in.
Yeah. Anyway, I think there's more room in this community for people to be, these agencies to be more open when they're wrong. And they very rarely are. And I think it's an opportunity to build trust. But I asked him, like, well, so does that mean you shouldn't have done desal? And he's like, oh, no, absolutely should have done it. In fact, we should do a lot more and that sort of thing so that we can actually become an exporter of water. So their new model is that they're so good at creating water and water availability that they want to like actually help if Arizona ever dries up, that they have a solution for them.
No.
Yeah.
That would be very stupid.
I would love to see
nobody buy our desert machine water.
Don't do that. It's not good for you.
Well, Greg Moran, so we've talked about the military. We've talked about how to supply it with some things it needs. Well, there's all kinds of ways that happens.
And drama.
And drama. There's a great story you've been following for years at the Union Tribune. It's the Fat Leonard scandal. And your last story, after all the changes at the UT, you were able to get a lot of the revelations from the documents and the court into print before you left. Nice work on that. It was a great read. So tell us this. So for those of you who have heard Fat Leonard or maybe just didn't dive into the stories, tell us the story of Fat Leonard.
Well, it's a great story. It was, you're right, it was the last story that was published in the UT that I did. And next month, like 6 weeks from now, 5 weeks from now, will be the 10-year anniversary, the 10-year mark since when the Fat Leonard case began. He was arrested in San Diego.
10 years already?
10 years.
I can't believe that.
September 16th, 2013, he was popped in a sting operation that was set up at the Marriott downtown.
Okay.
He was arrested in a luxury suite, and that started the public part of the Fat Leonard case, which is still not over.
Yeah.
He's not in the Marriott. He's not at the MCC. He's not on home arrest. He's somewhere in Venezuela because he escaped, which is kind of the last piece of the story. But overall, it's a remarkable story about an individual guy. This guy was a very kind of a remarkable guy, which is sort of what came out in a lot of these documents that were in the story that you referred to. But really, throughout his business career, he was a remarkable con man, you know, is kind of the best way to put it. And on multiple levels, I mean, he conned the United States Navy. When he got arrested, he kind of conned the Department of Justice. He conned the judge, I think, was presiding over this case to let him out because of health reasons. He was on a home arrest. He conned the people who were monitoring on his home arrest. And he's probably conning people right now down in Venezuela. Who knows?
he does best.
Yes, he is. And he's remarkable. You know, there was a guy in this trove of documents that we got, which was basically the entire discovery that the United States of the investigation that the government did from about 2011 through about 2017. And it was just a huge amount. It was a massive amount of records. It was like 330 some gigs on a hard drive.
It's like 14, maybe 15 million pages of records, maybe in this thing. It's incredible. The sweep of the investigation was just astonishing. So who is Leonard Francis? Well, he was a businessman. He was based in Singapore. He did, he was in a business called ship husbanding services, which is when ships pull into foreign ports, they need certain services. They got to get the sewage and the dirty water off the thing. They got to get clean water on. They got to get to shore. They need food. They need fuel. They need cell phones. They need all these things. And the husbanding agent is kind of the Mr. Fix-It, the local guy with local knowledge who's got local connections. That was the business Leonard was in. And over a period of time, his family had been in that business he was the third generation owner of it. He was the owner and the only stockholder in the thing. And over time, he built it into a very large business. He had a fleet, essentially. He had 40 or 50 ships. He had an air wing. He had a helicopter that was emblazoned with the GDMA thing. He had the home ship was called the Brave Heart. He had this kind of obsession with Scottish history because I think there's somebody in his family line who was from Scotland.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Mel Gibson.
No. His name is Leonard Glenn Francis with two N's, so he's in kind of a Scottish thing. And he was well known throughout parts of Asia. The area that he operated in is where the 7th Fleet, the United States Navy 7th Fleet operates, which is the largest fleet in the Navy.
My wife was in it.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And so many people from San Diego have a connection to this fleet and to the work he did there and knew Leonard and knew of Leonard. He was he's a big guy. He's not called Fat Leonard maybe he is out of Animus, but he was like 6'4", 6'3", 6'4". He's a big guy. He was a big personality. He was a hail fellow, well met. He was always on the docks and he was always a good time. He just had all kinds of money and party guy and things like that. And the case against him, the story of him is that over a period of time, he corrupted a number of people in the United States Navy with cash gifts and hotel stays and hookers and booze and wild parties and things like that to give him information about Navy operations, particularly in particular where ships were going to be. So he could get his business, he could get his resources and assets there and get the contract to husband the ships to provide them services.
Just some context on that too. Like there's that saying in the Navy, loose lips sink ships. Like there's a real taboo and like legal recriminations for anyone who talks about where the ships are and where they're going. So this isn't just about logistics, inside information. This is about national security.
This is crazy. So. Yeah, this is like OPSEC, personal everything. Just throw it out in the window, man.
Personal safety. And it didn't take much, if you look at a lot of these cases and the people who were prosecuted, to get these people to give him this information. It wasn't like he was giving them gold bars or things like that. It was like a couple of hookers and hotel stays and things like that. But once he got that, once he got his hooks into people and then was able to get access to the ships as they came into ports and get set up there, he would then provide the services to the Navy and then gouge them just shamelessly on price. So it's essentially a fraud case. It's a bribery case and it's a fraud case. And the fraud was monumental. I mean, it was tens of millions of dollars at least. In one of the documents, an agent estimates it's between $50 and $100 million he took off, fraudulently took off the United States Navy over a period of 10, 15, maybe 20 years. Wasn't super complicated. It wasn't this big Ponzi scheme or all like that. He would just send in bills that were inflated. He had people who were working for him or working on his behalf who liked him and who felt indebted to him.
So it wasn't just about like having a competitive advantage. Like he literally also just like got money he wasn't supposed to get.
Kind of both. Yeah. He would get money he wasn't supposed to, but he would also use these people to get a competitive advantage. So he'd want them to tell him what the other companies were bidding on various contracts or why they got it and he didn't. He was very, and he had these people running interference for him, some of them against his competitors who were down talking them and saying, oh, they're no good. We got to go with GDMA and we got to go with Leonard. So he did this and got away with it. And one of the things that we found out over this 10 years of prosecuting various people involved in this is that it was fairly well known that he was a kind of an unsavory character, a shady character. And even as I think an admiral or somebody said in the story that I wrote, a great quote, he said he had bad news written all over him. You know, he didn't want to go anywhere. A lot of people didn't want to go anywhere near this guy because his reputation preceded him. And he was known to be a guy who would really push the envelope or rip the envelope up and, you know, kind of keep going. But despite that, and despite many people complaining to him about, to the Navy about him over the years, he kept going and he kept going. And it wasn't until about 2011 or 12 when he got really greedy and really ripped off the Navy in Thailand that finally the military, the investigative services of the military, set up essentially a separate task force to go after him. And they did, and they investigated him for 2 years. They arrested him in San Diego in 2013. He begins almost immediately cooperating with the Department of Justice and giving them information. One thing we learned from this trove of documents was he came to San Diego and he had his laptop and a couple of phones. And Leonard was not a deleter. He was not a guy who kept his mailbox clean. So they had like every email he had sent from like 2007 on, and they dumped his phones, and they had his phones.
I'm going to do crimes tomorrow.
Let's scam the Navy.
Scamming today.
Yeah.
And they dumped his phones, and he had every text message from like 2009 or 11 to 2013. The phone document that the dump on his phone was a PDF I opened up, and this stuff is 2,300 pages.
Oh my gosh.
It's like every text. And this guy was like constantly online. This guy had like four or five things going.
Well, that
all
sounds
the time.
Fabulous. It'd be so nosy.
Oh, he would be.
Nosy. I'm like, ooh, what did he text?
He'd be texting. Well, that was good. That was, you know, the text messages end when he's arrested. And the last text messages are on the phone are people from back in Singapore saying, hey, can you give me a call? Hey, but try to reach you today. Huh? Hey, where are you? They had no idea. He was like face down, on the floor of the barrier.
Meanwhile, while he's singing, there's also these prosecutions going on.
Correct. So he gives them information. They have his records, and then they get his business records, and then he's talking to them. So they begin pursuing cases over what ended up being, I think, 33 people have been charged, indicted, and convicted. One person was not.
So he was talking to them as a way to like make
Cooperating. Mm-hmm. So he was hoping, he pleaded guilty in 2015 after a couple of years of talking to him, and then he continued to cooperate and give them information and, you know, help them bring cases against these other people, almost all of whom pleaded guilty without a trial, except for a handful of four or five guys who went to trial last year. It was the only trial in this decade-long thing, and it did not go well for the government, even though they ended up with convictions on four of them. The jury hung on a fifth. There were all kinds of allegations about prosecutorial misconduct and how they were hiding evidence from the defense. And the biggest surprise of it all was that Leonard Francis did not testify. Everybody thought this would be the big thing. He would come in and we would hear Leonard after almost a decade of not hearing from this guy. Nobody had seen him for 7 or 8 years, and he never showed up. They never put him on. They got the convictions anyway, and then it came time to sentence Leonard.
I mean, all they had to do was put up the dude's laptop.
Damn. Well, that's what they did.
Did he have to testify?
But that was a big issue because there was this, it gets very kind of legal technical, but there's this big issue about the chain of custody of those records, about were they authentic or not, and how much of them, really were his, and can you even bring them in the way they did? It's an issue in the post-conviction motions. But the capper of the whole thing is after all of this, after all of these cases, after all this publicity, there's at least one book in the works. I think there's a screenplay coming. You know, there's all this stuff going on. In September of last year, a couple of weeks, 10, 12, 15 days before he's supposed to be finally sentenced, Leonard Francis, who was not in the jail, he was out living in a very fancy mansion up in Torrey Islands, because he had medical problems, allegedly slices off his GPS bracelet on Memorial Day weekend, somehow gets into a car and drives away and ends up a few days later in Venezuela, where he remains.
So they found him, because there was a couple of days, right, where we didn't know where he was.
Many days were like 12 days, I think, 14 days.
And then
like
Venezuela
that.
Found him, but we're not like the closest allies with Venezuela.
No, right. And that's kind of been a black hole. I've been trying to find out for a year about where he's at.
Yeah.
But the State Department won't say anything. The Department of Justice won't say anything. My guess is, you know, Leonard is not sitting in a Venezuelan jail. You know, he's probably talked himself into some kind of beachfront condo in Caracas or something like that. But there is, and it's interesting because there is a school of thought among people who are still involved in the case under Bennett that maybe the Department of Justice doesn't want him back. You know, maybe because he's going to come back and maybe he's going to say, you know.
Maybe he has more stories to tell.
A lot of stories, or maybe he's just going to recant. And he's just going to say, no, I made all that up. You know, I mean, that's there's this.
I mean, it's pretty
concern.
Corny that they lost him. That's not
it's
good.
Terrible.
Yeah,
it's
very
bad.
Good sign.
Well, that's, like you said, like, so obviously this guy has a very persuasive way about him.
He's remarkable. Yeah. Somebody said in one of the records, somebody who dealt with him said he would have been a great case officer for like the CIA or the FBI.
Or reality store or reality show.
He'd be selling
star
millions of homes.
Who becomes a president, right?
He's so, got a great insight into people's weaknesses and exploits them.
Right.
You know, he could come back tomorrow. He could come back in 5 years. I mean, or he could never come back at all if he's still alive. You know, he does have some health issues, which I think. You know, he exploited rather well to allow him to live not just outside of MCC, which is a dump, but to live in a way that really I think kind of made a stooge or a monkey out of the court and out of the court system, because he had all these conditions. You got to stay there. You got to pay for your own security. You can only leave for certain reasons. You can't have a computer. You can't have a phone. You can't have visitors. Well. You know, he was ordering stuff for Amazon all the time. He had an entire room apparently that was nothing but computers and monitors. He had phones. He was calling people. He was living with his family had come over from Singapore and was living with him. His girlfriend was living with him and her son. He had an assistant. He hired a couple of paralegals. It was just like a nice
setup. I'm black and I cover the criminal justice system. And I want to make a note that this whole thing makes me mad.
Yeah.
It does. It's like crazy, dude. Like, seriously, there's someone in there for like minor drug offenses. They're like an ADX Florence in a basement, yeah. 23-hour lockdown. Nothing.
Yeah, but
right?
He had health
and this
problems.
dude, they lost him because he had a cough. He's just out there. Yeah. I mean, the dude, like, look at what these people are getting in trouble for. He got in trouble for like intelligence on Navy ships.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It was
okay. The dude is a G.I. Joe villain. Okay. Why were you like, yeah, we'll just anchor model to him? We'll just put the thing on the ankle and just let him. Like, that's not going to.
So I was just going to say you should write a book, but you said there's already books. And
there is, the excellent reporter from the Washington Post, Craig Whitlock, who's covered this and really, I've covered really most of it from sort of the court, federal agencies kind of thing. I'm not really deep into the military. He is a really excellent military investigative reporter. So he's writing a book. I understand that there's a screenplay, at least being kind of, drafted or done by the guy who wrote Crazy Rich Agents is what I understand is going to do it.
Wow.
And it is, the whole story is very cinematic. I mean, you have this larger than life figure, you know, literally like with wads of cash in his pockets, hookers in the back of his Hummer, boozing and entertaining, in these really wild parties, some of them Navy people in these exotic or kind of weird, foreign ports and locations and things like that. And at the same time, just pulling in massive amounts of taxpayer money with the assistance of a lot of people in the Navy. You know, he made his money by overcharging kind of in three areas, fuel, sewage, CHT, and this thing called force protection, which he would kind of after the coal bombing in 2001, the Navy was very concerned about people driving up to their ships with explosives and blowing them up. So Leonard came up with this idea called the Ring of Steel, and it was
those
a connection
balls?
Barges. No,
yeah.
Barges.
Oh.
Barges. He would link barges, these rusty old barge things, around the ships, and he called it the Ring of Steel. And he would charge enormous amounts of money for this. And it didn't do really anything. And it was kind of known within the Navy that people didn't like Leonard, refer to it as the Ring of Gold, because he would charge like $1 million for
a bunch of rusty old steel. That's
so good. Wow. The Ring of Steel.
Protected by the water.
Yeah, who do you think would stupid. Play him?
I don't know. It'd have to, probably not the guy from Selling big Sunset. Guy. I don't think. It'd have to be a big guy.
Oh, no. Jason and Brett are like shorter than me.
No, Leonard's a big guy.
I don't know. I mean, maybe they let him go because like some of this stuff sounds stupid on like Department of Defense level. Right. So like once I saw one Ring of Steel, I'd be like, this dude is.
Well, I would say
dude, I think we need that. I think he's up to something. Like, yeah, like I'm not an expert in this, but I don't think this is going to stop anything.
I think it's like that there's probably two things going on. One, with especially the time where the judge lets him go, right? Like that he's probably really persuasive and really charismatic, but also, he's playing a game with all of them. Where the prosecutors are probably like, they're probably half seduced by him too, trying to figure out like their own connections, what deals they've made with him to get this or that information. Some case goes bad, they need him to confirm something else. Next thing they know, they owe him a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And so them, and plus this persuasive capacity he has, it just seems like it probably adds up.
Yeah, I mean, it is very entertaining, but I'd also would say this is an extreme. Like I said for years, this was the most important case going on in the San Diego Federal Courthouse because it was so consequential, is so consequential to the Navy, not just for the embarrassment of just being, kind of people on the inside helping this guy, but just the obliviousness that they had to this fellow over a number of years. But it really, because the investigation went on so long and the Navy got really impatient with the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office around 2015 or 16, saying, when are we going to wrap this up? Because it was retarding the promotion and the movement within the Navy of people because they didn't know who really was on Leonard's payroll and who wasn't.
This man.
It was a very interesting situation with a guy named Locklear, who was an admiral in the Navy. In around 2015 or 16, he was on the short list to be the next Joint Chiefs. And then he wasn't. Then he didn't get it. And the Post had written a story about this, but I saw this in the documents. They came to Leonard in like 2015, or right around the time where his name was being floated. And they said, what do you know about Locklear? And he laid him out in like a 5-page, this guy. Yeah. I did this. Now, Locklear denies it all, and we should say that. He's just like, this guy is lying, and I never, I didn't take gifts, I never had a prostitute, things like that. But that record, I think, had a big reason why he was not, made that guy. So you're right, there was a lot of indebtedness, and they began to rely on Leonard. And just the duration of this, that cases kept going and kept going and kept going, kind of took on a life of its own. And it did kind of, punch a hole in the Navy. A lot of people couldn't move. And so they, instead, because they couldn't move up, they moved out. And so you started creating these gaps in the leadership.
Well, I was just going to say, like, this is really interesting. Like, the three of our stories were about entrepreneurs and these capitalists and such that have, like, been, working to, to get the government to make some kind of deal. Now, of however level of, corruption or not. And even your story is about an entrepreneur who, or various business people who are working with the law to get an edge. Yeah, that's really good.
The back end of business, American business. Yeah.
Well, Leonard was certainly a capitalist. He took the message to heart.
Well, that was great. I just want to say thanks to everybody who shared their story. And
good job. Yeah, no, that was awesome. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, Happy Hour Edition. If you enjoyed this special episode and want us to make more, let us know. Email our producer, Nate John, at nate@vosd.org. That's nate@vosd.org. Thanks again to our guests for this episode, Alon Stevens from The Trace and Greg Moran. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez Villafana is Managing Editor. And this was the excellent idea of our excellent producer, Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Friday for our weekly news roundup.